In effect, America no longer has a border. Every hour, foreign invaders surge into our country from the south.
It is a border crisis that Texas leaders say is costing you hundreds of millions of dollars every single year.
The monthly number of people apprehended on the southern border is the highest it's been in nearly 20 years.
The border crisis is showing absolutely no signs of slowing down.
Sources confirming to ABC News that the number of children detained at the border has hit a record high.
Some are calling a new humanitarian crisis is quickly unfolding at the southern border.
With illegal immigration at an all-time high, what can Americans do to combat this southern invasion? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
For decades, Americans have tried to get control of their southern border. But no matter how hard they've tried, foreign invaders keep illegally surging into the country. Is there anything Americans can do to combat this southern invasion? To find the answer, we're going to tell the story of one man's journey to California, and how in just two decades, he watched Los Angeles become the city of fallen angels.
It was around 1990, and Reverend Jesse Lee Peterson was working to rebuild Los Angeles black families when something started to hit his radar. Blacks and Latinos were in conflict.
We noticed that a lot of illegals had started coming into the country.
That's Jesse.
And as a result, the blacks and the Hispanics were fighting in schools.
The problems at Inglewood High go much deeper than today's riot.
Apparently, the whole thing began last February, when allegedly a group of Hispanic students walked out of a Black History Month assembly. Well, today it seems that a group of black students walked out of a Cinco de Mayo celebration.
Yes, we did walk out, but they don't want to hit us first.
Well, people were getting hit with bath bottles.
They just started saying black power, so they started hitting us, so we started hitting them back.
School officials canceled classes, dismissed students, and called Inglewood police. But the encounters continued outside, where even desperate parents looking for their children got caught in the middle.
Why you fight? Because you're black and a Mexican.
We had a meeting about it, that we was going to walk out on them, on their Cinco de Mayo thing, so we did.
They talk about this is a black school, this is a black city, this is, you know, our black neighborhood. It's not fair. We're Hispanics. We have a right to say whatever we want.
Besides Inglewood High School, racially motivated violence also broke out at Jordan High School and Manual Arts High.
By the early 1990s, tension had been brewing between blacks and Hispanics for well over a decade. Again, Jesse Lee Peterson.
They were holding the blacks back to try to teach the Hispanics who couldn't speak English and things like that. They were taking the jobs from the blacks, the low-paying job, low-wage job, and they were giving them to the Hispanics for cheap labor. And the so-called civil rights leaders and all those people were not doing anything about it.
That wasn't always the case in Los Angeles.
When I first moved here, there were no homeless people that I remember seeing. There were no homeless businesses everywhere. There were no drug addicts all over the streets, and crime was not out of control.
His experience in California shows just how much the state has been transformed by illegal immigration. Jesse Lee Peterson isn't a Los Angeles native. He was raised in the 1950s South.
I grew up in Alabama on a plantation right outside of Montgomery, Alabama. And my parents and their parents and their parents and their parents worked the plantation. My grandfather, when I was growing up, my grandfather was the manager of it. He ran everything there. And I grew up under the Jim Crow laws. And I used to have to ride the horse when I became a teenager. I had to ride the horse to go see my girlfriend. I lived in a tin roof house, and the bathroom was, you know, built outside of the house. So I grew up at a time when you would think that things was really bad for Black Americans, but they really were our best times. These are our worst times we're having now, but our best times were back then during the Jim Crow era, because we had families, we had parents and grandparents, and our parents did not hate anyone or blame anyone. We took responsibility for ourselves. They treated everyone the way that they would like to be treated, never mind the color. And we knew that the Jim Crow law, which was talked about rarely, but we knew it was organized by the Democrats, and they didn't want Black people in the Democratic Party at the time. And so we knew all that, but we also knew that all white people wasn't for that. They were not for the Jim Crow law. And so we treated people the way we would like to be treated. I remember for colors only sign, for whites only signs, but it was just the way it was. It didn't stop us from moving forward in life. Our parents believed in God. Unlike the Blacks today, they don't believe in God. They believe in color.
Jesse struggled in school and was at the bottom of his class. But his family instilled a work ethic in him.
I worked the plantation. The boys would be taken out of school to plant the crop. And then when it's time to harvest, to bring it in, we'd take it out to bring it in. I remember my grandparents telling me, we're going to raise you, but at 18, you're out of here. You got to go.
So when he wasn't in school, he was always looking to work. In the summer after his 11th grade year, his uncle from California gave him a call.
And he invited me out one summer to babysit for them. They're like, can you come out and babysit for us? I'm like, yeah. When I walked off the airplane in Los Angeles, I knew this is where I would live. It was like the palm trees, the weather, it was like paradise.
So he went back to Alabama with a purpose. He squeaked by and graduated high school, then went to Indiana to work just enough to buy a ticket to California. In 1968, at the age of 18, he moved to Southern California. Jesse first moved into his aunt and uncle's home in South Central.
I remember when I first moved into that area, it was mixed with Blacks and whites. A lot of white folks were still there. And it was beautiful, the houses were beautiful, and people were walking the streets and not afraid, because there were no gangs and things like that at the time. So you were not afraid to walk the streets.
He applied for a job at a local supermarket in South Central.
I got a job just like that, and because of plenty of jobs at the time. And I started out as a boss boy at the supermarket. Then I moved into the produce department because you can make more money there. And from there, I became a cashier. You can make even more money in the cashier's department. So I just worked my way up. And from there, I left and went to another company, Sears, and I started making more money there. But I loved the fact that the opportunities was here at the time in California. The people were friendlier at the time as well, because from what I can tell, Black people and white people got along during that time. We were friendly with the white folks in the neighborhood.
But trouble was quietly brewing.
Number one is the so-called civil rights movement that Martin Luther King started. That should have never happened, because it separated the people, and the so-called civil rights leader took over the minds of Black people and started making them feel like they were victims. And so most Blacks, but most Blacks stopped thinking for themselves as they turned their lives over to the so-called civil rights leaders, Jesse Jackson and all those guys. And they sold the Blacks to the Democratic Party under Lyndon B. Johnson for free money, welfare, and all that. And the civil rights people wanted power and wealth for themselves. So they start pushing this idea about racism, white people hate Black folks and all that, and the Blacks fell for it. I remember things changing when that happened.
At the same time that tensions between Blacks and whites began to grow in the early 70s, another phenomenon was impacting the Black community.
You started to have more out-of-wedlock birth, because when I was growing up, it was less than 10% of Black babies born out of wedlock. But when the civil rights leaders sold the Blacks to the government, and these women started getting checks, welfare checks and things like that, they stopped getting married. they started to have babies just to be on welfare, because the more children you had, the more money you would get. And so they started having babies out of wedlock, no more father and mother together. They started brainwashing the kids about racism in the schools. And it just, one thing led to another. And they noticed that white people were not speaking out against it. They were trying to appease the blacks. It just got worse and worse and worse.
With tensions high, whites began moving out of South Central and its neighboring cities in a process that would later be called white flight.
Eventually, white people moved away, and then the riffraffs came in with the gang violence.
Just as this social shift was occurring, the Los Angeles black community was hit by another development, illegal immigration. An influx of illegal aliens in California had slowly been increasing since the mid-1960s, but blacks were not the first to be impacted by it. In a 1974 interview, famed Mexican-American labor activist Cesar Chavez was asked how this invasion from the South was affecting the legal Hispanic residents of California.
Well, there's an awful lot of illegals coming in by the thousands. Some of the crews where there's now strike breaking, some of those crews are 100% illegals. Outright, openly, with no attempt to disguise it. And so it's so bad now that we estimate 60 to 70% of the farm workers in California, of the resident worker, of the citizen, is out of a job because of the wetbacks. They're coming in by the thousands, just unbelievable. See, they're coming in with the consent of the Immigration Service, which is part of the Department of Justice. We think that it's a prelude, the beginning to a big drive on the part of the administration and the Mexican government to bring the Bracero program again. It's a vicious attack on the local worker, and it's just one of those things that agribusiness thinks they can get away with it. And our job is to inform the whole country what's happening, together with a boycott, and solve it that way. And so the workers themselves, even though a lot of them are Mexican descendants themselves, are very uptight and very, very worried and very mad about the illegals coming to break their strikes, and it takes away their jobs, their livelihood, and so forth.
Does that put you in an uncomfortable position to be against the illegal immigrants because they are from Mexico? In other words, part of your program has been an appeal to equal treatment of people of Mexican origin, right?
Oh, yeah, sure, but we're speaking of the legal ones. You know, we don't want Mexico to export its poverty to us, and then we pay. It's not the agriculture, it's not society in general, it's a farm worker again paying for those sins, you know. And Mexico should take the initiative and stop exporting the poverty to us. They should do something about the rural economy over there. And then, see, it's a way of breaking the strike, it's a way of demoralizing the farm workers. And for instance, workers are going to ask for stamps, for food stamps. They're lining up the offices for welfare, and they're being told, we can't give you a job because there are plenty of jobs. And the workers say, well, there aren't any jobs. We just came from the fields, they won't hire us, or they just laid us off because either because we're strikers, or because we're members of the union, or because the illegals will do the job for half the money we're getting.
So by the mid-1970s, according to Hispanic labor activist Cesar Chavez, Latinos were surging across our southern border, taking the jobs of legal Hispanic residents in the agriculture industry. To get a feel for the size of the surge, in 1970, there were just 2.4 million Latinos in California. By 1980, in just 10 years, the Latino population almost doubled to 4.5 million. It was only a matter of time before the job losses caused by illegal immigration expanded from the agriculture business to the city of Los Angeles. And once it did, it would mainly affect poor blacks because the illegal aliens were taking low-skilled jobs and resources from their community. As whites began moving out of South Central and its neighboring cities, the area became more unstable.
I remember when the whites were run the whites away from their own areas, and the blacks would move in, and then it would just be gang violence everywhere. And then eventually the Hispanics start moving in, and they start fighting with the blacks, and things just got even worse then.
The problem of illegal immigration would become so out of control that it would enter the national stage. In 1982, Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming, a Republican, introduced the Simpson-Mazzoli Bill. The authors of the bill claimed it was designed to get control of the problem by forcing employers to verify the legal working status of their employees. It also purported to beef up enforcement at the border. In exchange, the bill would grant amnesty for any illegal aliens that arrived in the country before January 1, 1982. The Simpson-Mazzoli bill failed to be received by the House. Congress tried again in 1984 and again failed. As illegal immigration increased, D.C. politicians would eventually come together to solve the problem. But their solution would arguably become the biggest political mistake in modern American history. As the 1984 presidential election heated up, immigration became a major topic. In the second presidential debate, both Democrat nominee Walter Mondale and President Ronald Reagan were asked about the issue.
Mr. Mondale, many analysts are now saying that actually our number one foreign policy problem today is one that remains almost wholly unrecognized, massive illegal immigration. They are saying that it is the only real territorial threat to the American nation state. You yourself said in the 1970s that we had a, quote, hemorrhage on our borders, unquote. Yet today you have backed off any immigration reform, such as the balanced and highly crafted Simpson-Mazzoli bill. Why?
This is a very serious problem in our country, and it has to be dealt with. I object to that part of the Simpson-Mazzoli bill, which I think is very unfair and would prove to be so. That is the part that requires employers to determine the citizenship of an employee before they're hired. I am convinced that the result of this would be that people who are Hispanic, people who have different languages or speak with an accent, would find it difficult to be employed. I think that's wrong. We've never had citizenship tests in our country before, and I don't think we should have a citizenship card today. We need an answer to this problem, but it must be an American answer that is consistent with justice and due process.
Mr. President, you too have said that our borders are out of control. Yet this fall, you allowed the Simpson-Mazzoli bill, which would at least have minimally protected our borders and the rights of citizenship, because of a relatively unimportant issue of reimbursement to the states for legalized aliens. What priority can we expect you to give this forgotten national security element? How sincere are you in your efforts to control, in effect, the nation state that is the United States?
It is true our borders are out of control. It is also true that this has been a situation on our borders back through a number of administrations. And I supported this bill. I believe in the idea of amnesty for those who have put down roots and who have lived here, even though sometime back they may have entered illegally. And I'm going to do everything I can, and all of us in the administration are, to join in again when Congress is back at it to get an immigration bill that will give us once again control of our borders.
After he won re-election in 1984, Reagan would make good on his promise.
This bill, the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986, that I'll sign in a few minutes, is the most comprehensive reform of our immigration laws since 1952. Future generations of Americans will be thankful for our efforts to humanely regain control of our borders and thereby preserve the value of one of the most sacred possessions of our people, American citizenship.
But by signing the act into law, Ronald Reagan made the political mistake of the century. You see, the employer verification aspect of the act proved to be completely ineffective. Employers that wanted cheap labor found ways around the verification requirement. The loophole created a magnet for others to illegally enter our country in hopes of another future amnesty. When the act was signed in 1986, there was an estimated 5 million illegal aliens. One study estimates that the illegal alien population grew to 22 million by 2016. The act not only failed to control illegal immigration, it increased it exponentially. As the problem worsened, so did job prospects. In 1990, the American economy looked as if it was entering a recession.
Last month, wholesale prices were up by 1.6%. The price of gasoline alone was up more than 20%, and that is the largest one-month increase in the price of gas since the government began keeping a record in 1947.
Since the events in the Middle East, what we've seen is a much sharper reduction in consumer confidence, much more widespread concern that the economy may indeed slip into recession during this year ahead.
The predictions were correct. The early 90s saw the beginning of a recession, and the Golden State was hit especially hard. A reported half of the national job losses were in California, sending the state into a budget crisis.
The state will keep on issuing its infamous IOUs for another week or so while it negotiates a short-term loan to pay off the $3.5 billion in IOUs already issued since July. Budget slashing came at every corner. Health and welfare lost $1.7 billion. State aid to local governments lost $1.3 billion. The toughest cuts to make, $1 billion from public schools.
With budgets being cut in critical areas like health care, public education, and welfare, Californians started to look even more critically at the illegal aliens that were burdening those systems. Again, Jesse Lee Peterson.
And so they were giving the illegals free education and free health care and free housing while the citizens were suffering, and especially the black citizens.
At the time, Jesse Lee Peterson was becoming a national figure. He founded a nonprofit organization called Bond, dedicated to rebuilding the family by rebuilding the man, and was asked to make appearances on popular talk shows like Donahue and Geraldo.
Jesse Peterson, director and founder of a grassroots organization called Bond, Brotherhood Organization of a New Destiny.
First, I'd like to say that Bond is rebuilding the black community by rebuilding the black man. What happened, the black man has failed, and because of that, the black woman has to take the responsibility on the black man, and she can't handle the responsibility. And what she has done, because of her weakness, she has destroyed her children because she's not able to handle the household.
But what destroyed her children. Talk badly about their father.
Talk badly about the father.
You don't have to be black for this to happen.
As his organization grew, he began to notice how Los Angeles blacks were losing jobs to illegal aliens.
And it got so bad that the blacks in East L.A. and South Central L.A. were leaving their own communities and moving back to the South and other places because their leaders were not doing anything about it.
The issue was exploding in California, and even high school kids began to speak out on the issue. American blacks, Latinos, and Anglos attended an immigration policy forum in a city bursting with illegal aliens, Gardena, and they voiced their frustration.
You'd made the statement that immigrants' rights and privileges, yes, everyone deserves rights and privileges, but what you're saying is we need to put them above the rights of the American citizens. We have an unalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We're strangulating this with all the flushing in of everybody and giving them everything when college graduates from this country can't even get jobs because there is none.
When other immigrants come over to America, when they come over here, they must adjust to speak English instead of us adjusting to their lifestyles. They should adjust to ours.
And I'd like to say that I feel that we are enticing illegal immigration because all a woman immigrant has to do is have a child. We house them, we feed them, we clothe them. What else do they want? I mean, they're living in slums elsewhere, and they come here, they have a kid, and they're covered. I mean, they don't have to work or anything.
We know that two-thirds of the babies born in L.A. County Hospital are born to mothers who are in the country illegally.
These were Los Angeles high school kids of all ethnic backgrounds, and they were pissed about illegal immigration. In response to the problem, a team of activists formed a group called SOS, Save Our State. Their goal was to get an initiative on California's 1994 ballot that, if passed, would establish a state-run citizenship screening system and prohibit illegal aliens from receiving non-emergency health care, public education, and other services. Jesse's group, Bond, got involved with this effort.
I got involved, my organization, along with Barbara Cole and Isola Foster, Terry Anderson, and others, and we started holding rallies to bring attention to this. because the blacks was having a hard time. The illegal were moving into their towns.
Initially, Open Borders activists didn't take this effort seriously. It looked like an impossible task to get the initiative on the upcoming ballot. But by June 1994, the SOS team got the signatures needed.
Supporters are so passionate that something must be done, they collected more than 600,000 signatures to get it on the ballot, nearly a quarter million more than they needed.
The initiative became known as Proposition 187, and it became one of the most controversial ballot initiatives in American history.
California Republican Governor Pete Wilson embraced the initiative.
It has become the issue in the governor's race. Pete Wilson, a 187 supporter, is pinning his re-election hopes on anti-immigrant sentiment.
We are going to take back California for the working, tax-paying families of this state.
He ran hard-hitting advertisements promoting Prop 187.
They keep coming. 2 million illegal immigrants in California. The federal government won't stop them at the border, yet requires us to pay billions to take care of them. Governor Pete Wilson sent the National Guard to help the Border Patrol.
Polling showed Californians were overwhelmingly in favor of the proposition. It was popular among whites, blacks, and even Mexican Americans. That fact brought out the big guns.
Calling Proposition 187 inhumane, racist, and immoral, Jesse Jackson today publicly denounced the so-called Save Our State initiative.
Prop 187 would be a financial disaster for the people of California.
Flanked by Latino and black civil rights leaders, Jackson pledged African Americans will help defeat Prop 187 at the poll.
Latino activists, civil rights activists, and Hollywood celebrities took to the streets in a massive demonstration against the proposition.
Well, thousands of people marched through the streets of L.A. today, making a statement against the controversial ballot measure Prop 187. As many as 100,000 people turned out, saying the so-called Save Our State initiative would really sink our state.
Although many carried Mexican flags, organizers defined this protest as the new civil rights movement, impacting immigrants across the country, not just Southern California.
Well, David, Sylvia, the battlefield for the immigration issue is Prop 187. It would take away schools, health care, and other social services from illegal immigrants and their children.
Despite the vocal show of opposition in the streets, two polls this month show Prop 187 is riding high, ahead by 65-27% in the KCAL 9 News poll, and by 61-32% in this week's LA Times poll.
The issue became the center point of the race for California governor.
We can no longer afford to educate every child, every poor child from every foreign country.
And Prop 187 was one of the key issues Friday evening with Kathleen Brown and Pete Wilson squared off in their televised debate.
I think that the problem with Proposition 187 is that it is going to make a bad situation worse.
I think 187 not only is an opportunity to send a message, but it's something much more. It will create a lawsuit, for once a valuable lawsuit, that will go all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
When election night came in November 1994, Pete Wilson's gamble on aligning with Prop 187 paid off.
CNN is declaring in California, incumbent Republican Governor Pete Wilson has turned back the challenge by Democrat Kathleen Brown.
The Republican governor won re-election with 55% of the vote, but Prop 187 surpassed his margin. The so-called controversial proposition wasn't controversial at all. It passed with 59% of the vote. The results were clear. Both Republicans and Democrats wanted an end to illegal immigration. As Pete Wilson predicted, the day after Prop 187 won, a lawsuit was filed to block its implementation.
In California tonight, the popular will of the people and the determination of the governor on hold. A federal court judge has ruled not so fast with Proposition 187.
Federal Judge Matthew Byrne issued a restraining order which will prevent California from enforcing parts of the proposition.
In December 1994, a federal judge issued a permanent injunction of Prop 187, blocking most of its provisions. For the next 4 years, the new law would be battled in the court and on the streets. Jesse Lee Peterson used his platform to debate the issue within the black community.
Welcome to the Jesse Peterson Show. We're talking about a very important issue today, and I think that it concerns all of us, and especially Hispanics and blacks, I guess. but we're going to find out. We're talking about Proposition 187.
He also took to the streets demanding enforcement of the law. And when he did, Hispanic socialists used a tactic that would later be adopted by Antifa. They got violent.
So we would hold these rallies, and they were amazing, man. The Hispanic would come out there sometimes dressed in red, and they would have these were radical Hispanics, too. They would have frozen Coke cans and would freeze the cans and rocks and things, and they would throw them at us.
In one instance, he stood with a white man who was bloodied by the anti-Prop 187 protesters as a Univision reporter tried to accuse the bleeding man of being a racist.
Are you racist?
Am I what?
Why are you staying
here?
Said,
are you racist?
Am I racist?
Yeah.
No, I'm not a racist.
Are you a racist?
No.
So why would you ask him, is he a racist?
Well, let me see.
Why would you ask that question?
Why are you standing here? You're asking him
because he's white and you want to get away with this racist remark. Are you a racist?
No, no.
So why is it that he a racist because he's standing up for this country?
Do you like the Latin people? Do you like them?
No. Do you like them?
Yeah, I
do. You
I'm
like
Latin
America?
People.
Do you like America?
Yeah.
Then what's your problem? You should be out here picking in with us. That's a dumb question to ask. You're asking that question so you can use it on your program to make him look like a racist. Why don't you ask me, am I racist? Because I'm black, right? I love America too, and I think these illegal aliens need to be shipped back to their country. So why is that racist? You are racist for asking him that question.
Thank you, Jesse.
In 1997, a Jimmy Carter-appointed federal judge found Prop 187 to be unconstitutional. Pete Wilson appealed the decision to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It looked like it was going all the way to the Supreme Court. But in 1998, as the case awaited its day in court...
Also tonight, some very interesting governor races, none more interesting than in California, where we now project that the Lieutenant Governor Gray Davis, the Democrat, has defeated Attorney General Dan Lundgren. Governor Pete Wilson, of course, his term limited. Enormous win with all sorts of ramifications, I'm sure, Ted, you will talk about for the Democrats in the state of California.
Gray Davis almost immediately withdrew the appeal. Against the will of the people, Proposition 187 would never be implemented. The Open Borders lobby won, and they won big time. Over the next two decades, illegal immigration would only get worse in America, especially in California. In 1970, the state was 78% white and 12% Hispanic. In July 2014, for the first time, Latinos surpassed whites in the Golden State, and their numbers have only been increasing. Americans tried again in 2016 to regain control of its border by electing the biggest immigration hawk of modern times.
On day one, we will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall.
But just 4 years later, America's southern border experienced an invasion of illegal immigrants, the likes of which we haven't seen in a generation.
The border surge is breaking records. Over 172,000 migrants were stopped at the border last month, the most in 20 years. And almost 21,000 unaccompanied minors are now in federal custody, the most ever.
Which leads us back to the question, what can Americans do to combat this southern invasion? The answer is breed. Americans have exhausted every possible political remedy to stop the invasion of our southern border. We've passed ballot initiatives, elected congressmen, senators, and governors who've promised to stop illegal immigration. We put a man in the White House who floated ending birthright citizenship and promised to build a wall. Extraordinary activists like Jesse Lee Peterson have courageously tried everything. But all these efforts have only increased illegal immigration, and there appears to be no end in sight. The only new thing left to do is to follow some of the oldest and wisest words ever written. Be fruitful and multiply. This may be a hard thing to hear, but illegal aliens have won the battle. In the 9 presidential elections preceding Reagan's amnesty, Republican presidential candidates won California 8 times. but since 1988, they haven't won California even once. Ronald Reagan's decision to grant amnesty was perhaps the worst political mistake in modern American history. Our leaders will not control our borders, so we've entered a numbers game. We're not saying that we shouldn't fight every new attempt at amnesty. We're not saying we shouldn't vote out every open borders politician. But it appears that the only way to win the war against illegal immigration in the long run is to be fruitful and multiply. Because now that California is lost for the foreseeable future, Texas appears to be their next target. And these people, they mean business.
We gotta take our land back. This is us land. This is our land.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Thanks for listening.